This final reading of Darwin's diary starts with the Beagle's arrival in Australia. Although long before the Ashes, the 26-year-old Darwin was not very happy with the Australia he witnessed. He saw a bustling colonial society, sharply divided between convicts and free settlers, with the Aborigines and wildlife being pushed aside. From other remarks in this reading, we see that even after his visit to the Galapagos, Darwin still believed that species were created. In October 1836, the Beagle returned to England. Darwin hurried home to see his family, but now he had a new purpose ahead of him. He had collected thousands of geological and zoological specimens. He would spend over a decade publishing the results of the Beagle voyage. His findings and adventures would make him famous. But in the course of working through his materials, as he later wrote, he then saw how many facts indicated the common descent of species. His great work, On the Origin of Species, was published in 1859. Its opening sentence harked back to the voyage on HMS Beagle as naturalist. It and his book changed forever our understanding of life on Earth.
January 12, 1836. Early in the morning, a light air carried us towards the entrance of Port Jackson. A solitary lighthouse alone told us that we were near to a great and popular city. Proceeding further inland, beautiful villas and nice cottages were scattered along the beaches, and in the distance, large stone houses, two or three stories high, pointed out to us the neighbourhood of the capital of Australian civilization. We anchored within Sydney Cove. We found the little basin containing many large ships and surrounded by warehouses. In the evening, I walked through the town and returned full of admiration. It is a most magnificent testimony to the power of the British nation. My first feeling was to congratulate myself that I was born an Englishman. The streets are broad and kept in excellent order. The houses are of good size and the shops well furnished. In the streets, gigs, phaetons and carriages with livery servants are driving about. Sydney has a population of 23,000 and is rapidly increasing. It must contain much wealth. It appears a man of business can hardly fail to make a large fortune. I saw on all sides fine houses, one built by the profits from steam vessels, another from building and so on. An auctioneer who is a convict, it is said, intends to return home and will take with him £100,000. January 13th. I hired a man and two horses to take me to Bathurst, a village about 120 miles in the interior. By this means I hoped to get a general idea of the country. The roads were excellent and made on the macadam principle, nor had turnpikes been forgotten. I met two stagecoaches. In all these respects, there was a most close resemblance to England. Perhaps the number of alehouses was here in excess. The iron gangs or parties of convicts who have committed some trifling offence in this country appeared the least like England. They were dressed in yellow and grey clothes and were working in irons under the charge of sentries with loaded arms. I believe one chief cause of the early prosperity in these colonies is government thus being able, by means of forced labour, to open at once good roads throughout the country. January 16th. At sunset, a party of a score of Aboriginal blacks passed by, each carrying a bundle of spears and other weapons. By giving a leading young man a shilling, they were easily detained, and they threw their spears for my amusement. They were all partly clothed, and several could speak a little English. Their countenances were good-humoured and pleasant, and they appeared far from such utterly degraded beings as usually represented. In their own arts they are admirable. A cap being fixed at 30 yards distance, they transfixed it with the spear delivered by the throwing stick with the rapidity of an arrow from the bow of a practised archer. In tracking animals and men they show most wonderful sagacity. They will not, however, cultivate the ground, or even take the trouble of keeping flocks of sheep which have been offered them, or build houses and remain stationary. It is very curious thus to see in the midst of a civilised people a set of harmless savages wandering about and gaining their livelihood by hunting in the woods. The different tribes go to war. In an engagement which took place lately, the parties very singularly chose the centre of Bathurst as the place of engagement. The conquered party took refuge in the barracks. I left the high road and made a short detour to a farm called Wallerawang. Mr. Brown, a sensitive and well-informed Scotchman, had the kindness to ask me to stay the ensuing day, which I had much pleasure in doing. This place is one of the large sheep-grazing establishments of the colony. The sheep were 15,000 in number, feeding under the care of different shepherds. The number of assigned convict servants here is about 40. Although the farm is well stocked, there was an apparent absence of comfort, and not even one woman resided here. The sunset of a fine day will generally cast an air of happy contentment on any scene, but here the brightest tints on the surrounding woods could not make me forget that 40 hardened, profligate men were ceasing from their daily labours like the slaves of Africa, yet without their just claim for compassion. January 19th. The next morning the superintendent had the kindness to take me out kangaroo hunting. We rode the greater part of the day, but had very bad sport, not seeing a kangaroo or even a wild dog. A few years since, this country abounded with wild animals. Now the emu is banished to a long distance, and the kangaroo has become scarce. To both, the English greyhound is utterly destructive. It may be long before these animals are altogether exterminated, but their doom is fixed. The natives are always anxious to borrow the dogs from the farmhouses. Their use, offal when an animal is killed and milk from the cows, are the peace offerings of the settlers who push further and further inland. The thoughtless aboriginal, blinded by these trifling advantages, is delighted at the approach of the white man, who seems predestined to inherit the country of his children. In the dusk of the evening I took a stroll and had the good fortune to see several of the famous platypus. Mr. Brown shot one. Certainly it was a most extraordinary animal. A little time before this I had been reflecting on the strange character of the animals of this country as compared to the rest of the world. An unbeliever in everything beyond his own reason might exclaim, "Surely two distinct creators must have been at work. Their object, however, has been the same, and certainly the end in each case is complete." While thus thinking, I observed the conical pitfall of a lion ant. A fly fell in and immediately disappeared. Then came a large but unwary ant, his struggles to escape being very violent. The little jets of sand described were promptly directed against him. His fate, however, was better than that of the poor flies. Without a doubt, this predaceous larva belongs to the same genus, but to a different species from the European one. Now, what would the disbeliever say to this? Would any two workmen ever hit on so beautiful, so simple, and yet so artificial a contrivance? It cannot be thought so. The one hand has surely worked throughout the universe. 20th of January. A long day's ride. The country, with the exception of a few squatters' huts, was very solitary. A squatter is a freed man who builds a hut with bark in unoccupied ground, buys or steals a few animals, sells spirits without a license, receives stolen goods, and so at last becomes rich and turns farmer. He is the horror of all his honest neighbours. A crawler is an assigned convict who runs away and lives how he can by labour or petty theft. The bush ranger is an open villain, who subsists by highway robbery and plunder. Generally, he is desperate and will sooner be killed than taken alive. Before we came to the colony, I was most interested in the state of society amongst the higher and convict classes and the degree of attraction to emigrate. On the whole, from what I heard more than from what I saw, I was disappointed in the state of society. The whole community is rancorously divided on almost every subject. The whole population, poor and rich, are bent on acquiring wealth. The subject of wool amongst the higher orders is of preponderant interest. The very low ebb of literature is strongly marked by the emptiness of booksellers' shops. There are some very serious drawbacks to the comforts of families. The chief of these is perhaps being surrounded by convict servants. How disgusting to be waited on by a man who the day before was, by your representation, flogged for some trifling misdemeanour. On the other hand, the capital of a person will, without trouble, produce him treble interest as compared to England, and with care he is sure to grow rich. The luxuries of life are in abundance, and very little dearer, as most articles of food are cheaper than in England. I am not aware that the tone of society has yet assumed any peculiar character, but with such habits and without intellectual pursuits it can hardly fail to deteriorate. The balance of my opinion is such that nothing but rather severe necessity should compel me to emigrate. 14th of March. After several tedious delays, we gladly stood out of King George's Sound. Farewell, Australia. You are a rising child, and doubtless some day will reign a great princess in the south, but you are too great and ambitious for affection, yet not great enough for respect. I leave your shores without sorrow or regret. September 25th, 1836. Our voyage having come to an end, I will take a short retrospect of our 5 years' wandering. No doubt it is a high satisfaction to behold various countries, but the pleasures gained at the time do not counterbalance the evils. If a person suffers much from seasickness, let him weigh it heavily in the balance. I speak from experience. It is no trifling evil cured in a week. If he takes pleasure in naval tactics, it will afford him full scope for his taste. But even the greater number of sailors, as it appears to me, have little real liking for the sea itself. It must be borne in mind how large a proportion of the time during a long voyage is spent on the water, as compared to the days in harbour. And what are the boasted glories of the illimitable ocean? A tedious waste, a desert of water, as the Arabian calls it. No doubt there are some delightful scenes. A moonlit night with the clear heavens, the white sails filled by a gently blowing trade wind. It is well once to behold a squall with its rising arch and coming fury, or the heavy gale and mountainous waves, but it is a finer sight on the canvas of Van der Velde, and infinitely finer when beheld on shore. Let us now look at the brighter side of the time. There is a growing pleasure in comparing the scenery in different countries, which is distinct from merely admiring their beauty. It more depends on an acquaintance with the individual parts of each view. I am strongly induced to believe that, as in music, the person who understands every note will more thoroughly enjoy the whole. Hence, a traveller should be a botanist, for in all views, plants form the chief embellishment. Among the scenes which are deeply impressed on my mind, none exceed in sublimity the primeval forests, undefaced by the hand of man. These are temples, filled with the varied productions of the god of nature. No one can stand unmoved in these solitudes without feeling that there is more in man than the mere breath of his body. Of individual objects, perhaps no one is more sure to create astonishment than the first sight of a real barbarian, of man in his lowest and most savage state. One's mind hurries back over past centuries and asks, could our progenitors be such as these? Men whose very signs and expressions are less intelligible to us than those of the domesticated animals, who do not possess the instinct of those animals, nor yet appear to boast of human reason, or at least of arts consequent on that reason. It has been said that the love of the chase is an inherent delight in man, a relic of an instinctive passion. If so, I am sure the pleasure of living in the open air is part of the same feeling. It is the savage returning to his wild and native habits. I look back to my journeys through unfrequented countries with a kind of extreme delight which no scenes of civilization could create. Every traveller must remember the glowing sense of happiness from the simple consciousness of breathing in a foreign clime where the civilized man has seldom or never trod. October 2nd. After a tolerably short passage, but with some very heavy weather, we came to anchor at Falmouth. To my surprise and shame, I confess the first sight of England inspired me with no warmer feelings than if it had been a miserable Portuguese settlement. The Beagle proceeded to Plymouth. She moved down to Woolwich, and on the 17th of November, she was paid off. The Beagle was put into commission on the 4th of July, 1831, thus having completed the unusually long period of 5 years and 136 days.